Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. It's time for the wearing of the green as this week we celebrate St. Patrick's Day. Tulane professor Laura Kelly relates the long and storied past of the Irish in New Orleans. Then, 21st century Irish immigrants Pauline and Stephen Patterson share their story of pursuing the American dream by creating a home away from home at their mid-city pub, Finn McCool's. And we'll take a tour of Louisiana-style Irish pubs, where we'll lift a pint or two with you. We've got the luck of the Irish with us on this week's Louisiana Eats. Tulane professor Laura Kelly's book, The Irish in New Orleans, chronicles the stories of Irish immigrants in the Crescent City and how they shaped our culture today. In honor of St. Patrick's Day, Laura joined us to discuss what she's discovered in her many years of research on the topic.
Originally, it surprised me quite a bit to even find out that there were Irish in New Orleans, that there was this whole, you know, immigrant and ethnic group here, as I think it does many people. It's French, Spanish, Creole, and they say that like it's one word. But New Orleans has such incredibly rich history, and the Irish are an important component of that. So the Irish are here from the early French colonial period through the Spanish. But when do you move from being just a group of individuals who happen to be Irish to an, you know, ethnic community, a community? And we look at different markers to say, okay, this is when it's come together. And one of them is, of course, St. Patrick's Day. When do you celebrate a public feast day or saint's day that's associated with a particular group? And the earliest one here in New Orleans that I found documentation for is in March of 1806. So that is, yeah, so think about it. You know, we did the whole transfer with Louisiana Purchase in December of 1803. So this is 2.5 years later. And Governor Claiborne is there and, you know, various judges and other political people. So very similar to today. Certainly from 1806 forward, you see a lot of this continual public celebration of St. Patrick's Day. It may have happened earlier, but we don't have that many newspapers and it's hard to find evidence for. Other indications are when you build a church, when you have a charitable organization. So all of these things. And certainly charitable organizations happened in the 18-teens, and St. Patrick's is built in 1833. So certainly by 1833, there is a strong Irish community here, but probably I would say earlier, recognizable one.
Everybody who's familiar with New Orleans is familiar with that area that we call the Irish Channel.
Yes.
How did that become the Irish Channel?
The Irish Channel is fascinating because New Orleans is known for its neighborhoods, and they're known for their neighborhoods having very distinct boundaries from this street to that street. And the Irish Channel is not that way. It's completely different. You know, people in the 1930s and 1940s were arguing that it was only Adele Street, just two blocks of Adele Street, which is now unfortunately underneath Walmart on Chapatoulas. And others said it was broader from Jackson to Felicity. And of course, the Historic Landmark Society came in and removed that, and they moved it from, you know, Jackson towards Louisiana. For me, a couple of different things are important to look at. If you want to know where any Irish community is in any city, look where their church is. And St. Alphonsus, located on Constant Street, is in the heart to me of the Irish Channel. And that's in that location between Jackson and Felicity. And it was a church that was built with Irish sweat and Irish pennies and built by those famine immigrants, as was St. John the Baptist and Saints Peter and Paul over on the other side of town. So that gives you an indication of where the Irish community was expanding upon and how you can kind of connect the dots. But the Irish Channel, per se, the first documentation we have of when that term is used, again, public documentation, is in 1893 in a newspaper article, and the fellow being interviewed uses it as if it's been used in common practice for a long time. But he's very vague on the boundaries. He kind of makes it sound like it's from Canal Street upriver. So there is no real definition. I think the Irish Channel is where the Irish heart is.
Well, why did the Irish people settle there?
Before the Civil War and at the height of this Irish immigration to the United States, New Orleans had per capita more Irish than Philadelphia, Baltimore, Chicago, and was on par with Boston. And there might even be a little debate if we actually had more than Boston. So New Orleans was really quite the Irish city. And why come here? It's a bustling economic engine. And where did they settle? You settle where work is. You know, we're living in, certainly then, in a walking city. And so where you live, where you work, where you go to church, where you send your children to school are normally all within walking distance. And while the Irish were involved in every type of occupation from, you know, from a drayman to a doctor to a teacher to a laborer, many of them worked in the port. And that was, you know, New Orleans was the second largest port in America. So if you're working in the port, you're living near the port, and where's the Irish Channel? I mean, one thing that people do agree upon, it's below Magazine, right? Mm-hmm. So you're not that far from the river.
You have a whole chapter in the book that you call Irish Influence on the New Orleans Culinary Landscape.
Mm-hmm.
What is the Irish influence?
That is a great question, and I think you have to approach it from a lot of different ways. The Irish are known for actually their absence of food ways. If you look at the Italian, they have very strong food ways. And we associate certain dishes automatically. With the Irish, what do you associate with them? Potatoes and more potatoes.
But we don't really have any famous New Orleans potato dishes, do
we? No, we don't. And there aren't any more famous, you know, potato dishes, to be fair, to the Irish. And when I say an absence of food ways, the reason for their mass migration to the United States was the failure of one crop. It was the potato crop. And then you have to stop and ask yourself, how does the failure of one crop affect mass migration? Food is still being grown in Ireland. Mm. Well, it affects it when 60% of your population is eating solely or mainly just potatoes. How did they eat them? Two main ways, gruel or baked potato. And this was without butter and salt or pepper or anything. And so you have a devastation of a crop. You come to America and your association with food is famine. You know, your main one food source is famine. And when you study the Irish, what's one of the first things they do when they come to America? They become everybody's cooks. And I think one of the reasons they become their cooks is because they're like, teach me what you want. Uh-huh. You know, they're kind of a tabula rasa. They're a blank slate. And I think in the city, what you see are individual Irish people who influence food in their own way, but not necessarily in a way that we would consider an Irish food way. So influence to me is people. It's like, you know, Dickie Brennan, or it can be someone like Pauline Patterson taking a comfort food for her and adding a Louisiana twist to it.
Of course, you know, as we search for those thin culinary threads,
yes,
in New Orleans, there's one thing that it is not difficult to search for at all, because you can stumble across one in certainly every neighborhood, and that's the Irish bar.
Oh, pub, please.
Yes, okay.
Pub, please.
All
no,
right, okay.
There's a difference between a pub and a bar. You know, a pub is where you go when you want to share good news. A pub is where you go when you have really bad news and you want to just be with friends. It's, you know, an extension of your living room. And we have many of them here in the city, which is very good news for us. And I think that is a true Irish institute, because the first place an Irish-born person today, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, whenever would have done when they arrived new in the city, is they would have found the first Irish pub. And then they would have announced who they were, find out if there's anybody from their part of Ireland, look for a place to stay, look for work. In other words, that was your port of entry. you know, the church and a pub. And today, the church doesn't play that role really to the same degree, but a pub does. And a pub is very important to, I think, the Irish psyche because, you know, over 100 million Irish people, you know, make up the diaspora. And with the economic downturn 2008, Ireland again began hemorrhaging people. And so when you're a stranger in a strange land, finding a comfortable, familiar place is very important. And that's what a pub does.
Please, Laura, just give us the highlights of some of your favorite Irish pubs and what makes one different from the next.
Okay, see, now you're going to make me choose, like, favorite children here, you know.
Just off the top of your head, give us a little waltz around.
Well, if we weren't going to worry about distance, okay, we're not literally walking from one place to the other, although we could definitely sober up in between these places. Finn McCool's would be my starting point. And I would start with Finn's, and then you've got sort of the Holy Ground that's not very far away in mid-city. Matt Murphy's The Irish House is definitely worth, you know, relaxing your feet. It's beautiful interior and a really warm and inviting space. And he holds every Monday these music sessions, these Keelys. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we'll end up at Matt's. I would definitely go to the Carry in the Quarter, without a doubt. The Aaron Rose. And as I'm working my way through the Quarter, I'd stop at Molly's, of course.
Of course you'd have to stop
stop at Molly's.
For a frozen Irish coffee.
And raise a toast to Jim Monahan.
What a guy.
And then, you know, we have Henry's. And looking into that and seeing that four generations of, you know, one family pulling some draft beer and giving some whiskey to all of us. And whiskey, to me, is actually a great Irish foodways. Whiskey in Gaelic means the water of life. And that, I think, kind of says it all.
Well, I really am so thrilled that we were able to have this conversation
with you.
Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Laura Kelly, adjunct professor of history at Tulane University. Laura's book, The Irish in New Orleans, is available in bookstores everywhere.
Back across the ocean to my home away from home. I'm glad to be returning, but sad to have to go. I'd like to find a way to be two places at one time. But it's easy going back again, but it's hard to say goodbye.
After Laura Kelly told me all about the history of Irish immigrants in New Orleans, I wanted to go straight to the source and talk with some modern-day Irish immigrants. But Pauline and Stephen Patterson are more than just immigrants. They're the owners of Finn McCool's, a traditional Irish pub that can satisfy anyone who's looking for a taste of the Emerald Isle. I sat down with Pauline and Stephen to find out what brought them together, and then what brought them to New Orleans. So take us back to the beginning. How did the two of you come together in the first place?
I worked at a store called Dunn's Stores, which is sort of like the equivalent of Target, I suppose. It's an Irish-owned clothing and grocery store. And we had our annual May ball at a local
nightclub
called the Corngrove. And Stephen was working at the nightclub and I was there with all my friends and workers. And at the end of the night, when after they've called last call,
yes,
all of the workers get a chance to fraternize with the guests. So he asked me up to dance.
We were always allowed 30 minutes before we had to finish our shift to go out and have one drink. And we were only 17 then, by the way, just so you know.
Both of y'all were just 17.
Yeah, we were 17.
That's so sweet.
And I'd been keeping an eye on Pauline during the night as I was working. And, you know, most nights we would get off and I'd ask a girl to dance, and sometimes it would happen and sometimes it wouldn't. So we had 30 minutes, so I knew I had to make my move. So I asked Pauline to dance, and luckily she said yes.
He asked me what type of music I liked, and I said, oh, I really like Bette Midler. And he goes, yeah, my ma likes her too. So I said, what type of music do you like? And he goes, I like Northern Soul. And I went, oh, I've never heard of them. And it's a genre of music.
Oh.
So after two insults, we still are together.
That's right.
And how many years has that been?
30 years.
30 years. That's the luck of the Irish.
That's it.
How did you get a notion to come here?
Well, we grew up during the Troubles, so we were encouraged by both sets of our parents to leave Ireland as soon as we could, because there's always a chance that you could get caught up in it. And, you know, so basically we were encouraged to leave. My mum and dad regret it now because they're at home, and it's sort of hard for us, you know, seeing them getting older, but they get to come and visit, which is brilliant.
Yeah, growing up in Ireland, I mean, we grew up in the 70s and 80s, and there was a lot of political strife going on, and there was high unemployment. So Pauline had an uncle in America, and he was the first one to sort of invite us to come. You should come over to America and check it out. So that was a dream of ours. So once we did, we saw that there was money to be made. We saw that there was, you know, nobody mentioned politics, or Irish politics anyway, where we were. So that was sort of good. Everybody got along. And we loved the, you know, the atmosphere and the freedom that America gave you.
I had read A Streetcar Named Desire, and I had wanted to see where it was set. And we came here, we worked in Wildwood, New Jersey for a couple of summers. And one summer we made a bit of extra money that we could afford to travel. And we came down to see where A Streetcar Named Desire was set. We were only supposed to stay for a couple of days and then work our way back up the coast and then fly back to Ireland. And what we ended up doing was staying in New Orleans the entire 2 weeks, flying back home, finishing college, and flying straight back out. We just fell in love with how friendly New Orleanians are, and the food is amazing.
Every day when we were thinking about leaving, there was something else came up that we had to see and visit. So that was awesome. So once we went back to Ireland, our whole focus was just getting ready for our return to New Orleans, and we knew that we wanted to come back here. So you basically work and save up for the whole year. Pauline was finishing university. I was working in the bars back there, and the moment Pauline finished her college, she didn't even stay for her graduation.
Yeah, I just made sure that I'd passed.
Whenever they told her she'd got her degree in art, we basically got on a plane, two rucksacks and as much, you know, cash as we could get, a couple hundred bucks each, came to New Orleans. Wow. And lived in the French Quarter for the first couple of years. Then, you know, we got married here.
Yeah.
Then just started to build a life. And back then, the summertime, it was a wasteland in New Orleans. You know, it's very tough. There was no conventions coming. And the bartending, we weren't making a lot of money bartending back then. So we wanted to do something else. So we started buying houses, old houses, and fixing them up. And we didn't really have any experience in that.
But you had a hammer.
Yeah. So that was something we learned on the job, you know. And we, over the past, you know, 25 years, we've bought and renovated close to 30 different properties.
Well, Stephen, I'm so curious. You know, contractors work really hard. They kind of work dawn to dusk. But becoming a bar owner, now that's another whole bailiwick, you might say.
Yeah. Absolutely.
What possessed you?
We fell into it by accident.
Well, I was working, obviously we both worked in bars. I worked for 12 years at Mix Irish Pub on Bienville Street, and a group of my regulars came in and they were having a great time. I was telling them jokes, pouring them drinks, and then after about the fourth drink, one of the men called me over and said, "Can I ask you a personal question?" And I said, "Yeah, go ahead." And he said, "What's a middle-aged woman like yourself still bartending for?"
Oh, that's
and
charming.
And I was 35. I went, "Are you joking me?" So I realised at some level, fellas have a longer shelf life as a bartender than women do, which is unfortunate. So after staring at myself in the mirror for about 2 weeks solid, going, "Why is he calling me middle-aged?" I decided to go into real estate. That was something that you could do sort of part-time and I could still keep the bartending job. So I became a real estate agent while Adder and Bloom, and I was tasked to find one of my clients a bar. He specifically wanted to buy Mix, so I approached the owner of Mix and he went, never, I'm never selling, but I know another bar that's for sale, so why don't you approach that person? So I brought my client to that bar, which is now Finn McCool's, and he said, you couldn't pay me to buy this bar, which is a testament to what type of bar it was before we took it over. So after long discussion, myself and Stephen and another couple decided we would go in for it and buy it.
We opened the bar in July of 2002, and it was a struggle at the start because it was a
dicey neighborhood.
People that we knew from other bars. We were both working at bars then. I was working at O'Flaherty's in the French Quarter, and Pauline was working another bar in Mid-City. So, but they didn't want to travel. They thought that was a different part of the city that they just didn't want to go to, below Canal Street.
Mm-hmm. Or below Carrollton.
And below Carrollton. Yeah. So it took a while. And it took, 3 years after that. So that's the summer of 2005. We were trying to position ourselves as a New Orleans neighborhood bar with Irish and international niche sports. So we would get games in on the big satellite dish that no other bars would carry. And we would show them at 2 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning. Because of the time difference, they were coming from all over the world. And sometimes we only had 2 people, but sometimes we had 100 people. So you had to show them all to make sure that you would be able to catch those big games. And
because it was like buying a package deal.
Yeah. Yeah, but that was just that was like an effort that we did, that we wanted to try and differentiate ourselves. We just didn't want to be another watering hole, if you know what I mean. We wanted to be a community-led pub that would be an extension of people's living rooms, and where they would come to meet other people, come to get work, come to, if they needed to raise money, if they needed help, they would come to Finn McCool's to get help. If they wanted to give help.
Networking.
Mm-hmm. It was the original networking place.
Yeah, 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 baby, it's out of sight.
When we come back from a short break, we'll learn how the Pattersons came close to losing everything they built in Katrina, but with the support of their regulars, were able to come back even stronger. Stay tuned.
The chicks are out of sight and I'm approving, yeah. The crowd is in tonight, begging for more. While I get my kicks out on the floor.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Now, we continue our conversation with Pauline and Stephen Patterson of Finn McCool's Irish Pub.
So you had owned Finn McCool's for 3 years when Hurricane Katrina happened.
Yeah.
You know, we were going to open that Sunday, and we made the decision Saturday night, and we called the bartenders and said, okay, we are going to close. They've just issued it mandatory. But the girl, we were at the bar on Sunday morning, packing stuff from the bar, heading out, and the bartender came to come to work. And we were like, no, we texted everyone and said, you know, we're evacuating. And she went, oh, okay. But, I mean, that just shows you how...
Yeah, it's a story that's been told 100 times. I'm sure you've heard it. We were in the same boat as everybody else.
Yeah.
We didn't know whether to leave or not. Whenever we decided to, we thought we were only going to be gone for a few
days.
You know, so we thought we'd just come back, you know, mop or cut down the tree limbs that were usually blowing over. There might be a little bit of flooding. You mop it out and you just continue on.
So you left on Sunday?
We left on Sunday. And then we met up with my sister and Stephen's brother, and we stayed for 6 weeks in Abbeville.
Oh.
Crowley. Or Crowley, actually.
Crowley.
Our friends that own the house in Crowley live in Abbeville. We stayed there for 6 weeks.
We didn't get any news for the first couple of days. So after the storm, we finally got in touch with one of our bartenders who had stayed in Mid-City. Mm-hmm. And she finally got a text to us. I think it was Thursday night. After, and we did, because where we were, we didn't have any TV. We were staying. We didn't have a TV or radio or anything. Yeah. So we didn't really know what was going on, what parts of the city were flooded or weren't.
And the people that were showing it on the TV wouldn't say, well, this is Mid-City or this is up. Or, you know, they just were saying, oh, New Orleans is flooded.
Yeah, so we finally got the text on the Thursday. So I guess that was 4 days after the storm. And that was, she just said, yeah, the bar is gone.
Oh.
So it gives me goosebumps now just thinking about it.
Yeah. And Ian McNulty actually sent us a photograph. He got a press pass and he actually sent that iconic image of Finn McCool's underwater. And it was the most shocking thing. I think we held it together. Like, we didn't get upset. I mean, not that we were upset, but we didn't cry or anything the whole time that we were away. And we came back with, they issued the saying that 70119 could come back. So we arrived at the bar and I was about to cry, but Stephen actually was really, really upset and I just like sucked it in and it was just devastating just seeing everything that, especially because Stephen is the labourer, so much of his actual physicality went into the building. To see it completely destroyed was just so surreal.
So where do you start to rebuild?
We weren't sure if we were going to rebuild, you know.
Because nobody knew.
Yeah, nobody knew what was going on. And but we got in there and just started, you know, the first day that afternoon, just started taking stuff out. I guess we're into October, towards the end of October when we started pulling stuff out. And by
noon
that day, there was probably 15 or 20 people helping us.
Mm. Yeah.
Customers that have been driving by, people in the neighborhood, they would always drive by and they were saying to us, oh yeah, we've been driving by for a few days. And as soon as we saw the door open, we wanted to come in to make sure you guys were coming back. And we were saying, well, we're not really sure. Are you guys coming back? And they were saying, well, it was all, well, I'm not really, we won't come back if you aren't coming back. There's no point. So it sort of, you know, galvanized us. Yeah, it made us
a so much stronger community.
Yeah. And, you know, that was the point, I guess, when you realize this is our home. You know, we are Irish. We grew up in Ireland. We'll always be Irish. But that was whenever we realized New Orleans was home for us.
And we had the soccer team that had been training all that summer leading up to a game that they didn't actually get to play. And if it wasn't for Benji Haswell and Stevie Ray and Paul Medhurst, who galvanised everybody and kept them on, and this, hardly anybody texted back then, but they used email and text and to basically get everybody together. So after we got everything out of the bar and it was ready now to be insulated and sheetrocked, and we decided the place looked gorgeous for it being in such a desperate condition, and we decided to throw a party. So we invited everybody and we had gone out to Sam's and we got a load of beer and a load of food and we set everything up, called everyone. Everybody arrived and it was so cathartic and people were crying and hugging each other and they were like, oh, we have to do this every week. You know, we have to get to... And when everybody left, we had more beer and food than when we started. It was like the New Orleans version of the loaves and the fishes. So we did it five more times before we actually opened on St. Patrick's Day of 2006.
So tell me about St. Patrick's Day 2006.
Oh, it was amazing. It was like we had been working so hard. Like, the bar stools arrived that day and it was like people were coming in and going, oh, we're ready. And they're going, okay, unwrap your bar stool. Otherwise, you know, don't lean up against that wall because that wall's
We weren't
still
sure
wet.
If we were going to open or not because we didn't have electricity until February of 2006.
Oh,
so
my
we had
gosh.
Planned to try and get open as soon as possible. But once we got the electricity back on, we knew then St. Patrick's Day would be the date, March 17th, 2006. And, you know, you were still putting the finishing touches on the place, but it was a great way to
restart
a new beginning, let everybody know that the Irish were still here in New Orleans and this was our day still. And, you know, we wanted to celebrate the rebirth of New Orleans.
So basically, the day, St. Patrick's Day itself, it starts off really, really early, and we do Irish breakfast sandwiches with Irish sausage, Irish bacon, black and white pudding, fried egg, cheese. And we used to serve it on a plate, but not everything got eaten. So we now what we've done is put it into a big crusty bap, and you can have HP sauce with it. So you, at least you line your stomach first thing in the morning. And then we have what we call the Irish Olympics throughout the day. It's cabbage bowling and cabbage and carrot and onion juggling and Guinness flip cup, and we're going to have 50 Shades of Green fundraiser for St. Baldrick's Day. And then we put out free food on at 3 o'clock on St. Patrick's Day, and it's Irish stew and shepherd's pie, and we obviously do the Irish American corned beef and cabbage.
Who does the cooking, Pauline?
I do.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to have a lot of help from the kitchen this year, though, so that's awesome. And then we've done this the entire time that we've owned Finns. We have the weest parade in the world. Finns is a long, narrow bar, but it has a front door and a side door that is probably only
40 feet.
40 feet at the most. We have a king and queen. We have St. Patrick and St. Bridget. We have a leprechaun. We have floats made out of cardboard that people step into, and we parade from the front door to the side door, and it's over. We might, for everybody to do it, we'll have to do it several times, but we have a bagpiper that leads it, and we have...
So it's the shortest, we're trying to get it recognised as the shortest Irish parade in the world.
Well, it sounds like really a good time. Yeah. I can't wait for St. Patrick's Day. Yeah. I'll be there.
Yes. Fantastic.
I have to make sure it doesn't rain.
Well, I really want to thank you guys so much for spending this time with me and telling me your really inspiring stories. You know, America could use more immigrants.
I agree.
Yeah.
Thank you, Poppy.
I'm glad you all are New Orleanians. Thank you.
Thank you. It was brilliant. Thank you.
Pauline and Stephen Patterson of Finn McCool's Irish Pub.
All you heard for years in Ireland was the wearing of the green, but the biggest change has come in Ireland I have ever seen. All the laddies and the coolies laid aside their Irish reel, and I was born in Ireland, so imagine how I feel. Now Ireland's gone black bottom crazy. See them dance, you ought to see them dance.
Finn McCool's Tiny Parade is only one of countless St. Patrick's Day celebrations you can find throughout the state of Louisiana. Producers Joe Schreiner and Sarah Holtz visited a handful of Irish pubs to hear about their traditions and St. Patrick's Day stories.
My name is Sarah, and I work at Fahey's Irish Pub, 540 Burgundy, in the Quarter. We have corned beef and cabbage. We do a spread. It's all day long. And then we party. So we have regulars. We have locals that have been coming here for 20 years. We've been open for 23 years. So they come, and then the usual mix and mash of tourists that come just for the weekend. But we always do the corned beef and cabbage on St. Patrick's Day. We don't wait for the weekend. We do it on the day that's proper. So if it's a Thursday and it's slower, so be it. It makes our regulars happier when there's no line for the good food. About 3 years ago, we had a marriage on St. Patrick's Day. The little chapel in the Quarter, that's about 3 blocks down on Burgundy. It's where the owners got married, actually. They gave us a call. It was on St. Patrick's Day, and they said they had a couple that wanted to be married on St. Patty's Day in an Irish bar, and would we host it? And we said, absolutely, and they came down. And a couple of people from central Louisiana, I remember, were visiting, and they were witnesses. Didn't know the people, but they're fast friends now. And they got married in the bar on St. Patty's Day. I think it was 3 years ago. I know it was a Saturday or a Sunday.
I'm Rebecca. We're at Molly's at the Market on Decatur Street. Last year I worked on St. Patrick's Day, and in the morning it's a little slow, but as soon as the parade in the Bywater gets down here, it is packed. I was the only bartender here, no bar back. It was insane, just running around pouring Guinness all day, which is the slowest beer to pour. It was funny, all day people were asking me, they're like, are you by yourself? It's like, yes, and I can't drink. But it was fun. It was a good day, and everyone's in good spirits because they're drinking all day. So.
Yeah, my name's Brian McIntosh, and I'm here at the Kerry Irish Pub, 331 Decatur Street. Here at the Kerry, St. Patrick's Day? We probably open up around 10 o'clock or so. We have music from 11 till about 2 in the morning. I mean, you have the Downtown Irish Club come through here. So we sell a lot of Guinness. You smile, dirty jokes. You know, you got to kiss the girls. And, you know, try and stay out of trouble the best you can. And mostly sober. Mostly. We get, I don't remember the radio station, but they're out of Ireland, and they call us like every couple of 3 years and ask us random questions. And I remember they were asking, do we happen to know the Irish National Anthem? And over on the wall, we have it, but I don't speak Gaelic. And they have it in Gaelic, and they have it in English. So I start trying to read it, and they're like laughing at me. And then who do I have right here in this seat right next to me? I've got a guy from Ireland, and he's like, no, shut up, I'll tell you what to do. Give me the damn phone. And he gets up and he sings it for him. And they're on the floor just laughing. And so, I mean, you know, here are the Irish and New Orleanians, like, what? And we're on the floor, you know, I mean, what, you can't buy that kind of thing.
My name is Jeff Carreras, and I am the owner, proprietor at Tracy's Original Irish Channel Bar. I am Spanish, Italian, and Irish by investment. We have the parade day here, and lots of green beer, lots of Jello shots, plenty of corned beef and cabbage, and roast beef po' boys. I mean, it's probably a good 10,000 people that run in between throughout the day. So it's a pretty wild scene out here. I think the worst thing that ever happened was that actually a man had a heart attack inside the bar on St. Patty's Day. Scary and disappointing, I guess, because who wants to die on St. Patrick's Day? It's such a fun day. But he didn't die, so I guess he was lucky. Luck of the Irish.
What was the cause of the Great Irish Potato Famine? We'll answer that question and explore that dire time when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets.
The island that is silent now, but the ghosts still haunt the waves, and a torch lights up a famished man who fortune could not save.
Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What was the cause of the Great Irish Potato Famine? First, it's important to note that from the late 1700s on, the poor in Ireland subsisted entirely on one variety of potato. An average Irishman ate 14 pounds of boiled potatoes every day. But in September of 1845, when the annual potato harvest was about to begin, without warning, the leaves of the potato plants began to curl up, turn black, and rot. The plants actually began to ferment, creating a nauseating stench across the land. At first, when the farmers dug up the potatoes, they appeared to be fine, but within days, they shriveled up and rotted. The culprit was an airborne fungus that quickly spread across Ireland in the cool, moist air. That first year, the poor Irish survived by selling their livestock and pawning off their meager belongings. But when the crop failed entirely in the second year, the Great Starvation set in. Irish in the countryside began to live off wild blackberries and ate nettles, turnips, old cabbage leaves, edible seaweed, roadside weeds, and even green grass. Tragically, the populace sickened and began to die.
the lucky ones made it to America, the land of plenty, where today they're an important part of this country's cultural heritage. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
Sailing angels over me, tell a tale of all those sinfuls. Look for you to change their face.
Food writer Scott Gold got a crash course in Irish cuisine when he first visited the Emerald Isle 10 years ago. Here, Scott proclaims his love for the calorific and over-the-top Irish breakfast.
When I first visited Ireland a number of years ago for a wedding, I didn't really know what to expect when it came to the cuisine. Given my limited exposure to Irish food, my first thought, of course, was potatoes and corned beef and cabbage, the usual stereotypes. As it turned out, the cuisine of the Emerald Isle has way more in common with my Louisiana home than I had imagined. First of all, there were oysters. Great ones, too. The city of Galway, one of my favorite places on the face of the planet, is actually renowned for their bivalves, and they even host one of the biggest oyster festivals in the world. Add to that the fact that Galway is a city on the water, and that it also has a rich music and drinking culture, and it's hard not to call the place the New Orleans of Ireland. But there was one aspect of food in Ireland that I hadn't given much consideration. Breakfast. On my first morning in the town of Sligo, where the wedding would be held, I encountered for the first time the unabashed, shamelessly brazen nature of breakfast in Ireland. The owner of the bed and breakfast in which we were staying also doubled as its cook. He asked me that morning what I'd like to eat, and I deferred to him, seeing as I didn't know what my options were, and I assumed he would know better than I. "How about a full Irish?" he asked. I paused to consider this, for a couple of reasons. First, offering to give someone a full Irish can sound slightly dirty if your brain is inclined in that direction, which of course mine is. Second, I had no idea what it meant. Would he roast a sheep in the yard for me? Would there be Guinness? Or maybe even whiskey? Singing? Fighting? Again, I deferred to the Irish inn owner and just went with it. Not long after, our friendly B&B proprietor set before me a plate filled with the kind of food that you might desire if you were, say, scaling the cliffs of Moher that day, or maybe going into battle against hordes of bloodthirsty Viking invaders. There was bacon, thick rashers more like ham than the crispy bacon we're accustomed to in the States, as well as sausage links, black pudding, which is blood sausage, white pudding, a sausage more like boudin, two sunny-side-up eggs, and thick slices of rustic toasted black bread. There was, essentially, enough meat and cholesterol on this plate to choke a manatee, and the only thing even hinting at a fruit or vegetable was a single stewed tomato, which seemed to me like an afterthought, if a tasty one. As for condiments, I was offered only one. "Would you care for some brown sauce?" the man asked me. Again, my ignorance reared its head. "What is brown sauce?" I inquired. "Well," he replied, thinking of an appropriate description, "it's a sauce, right? And it's brown. Brown sauce." I said, "Okay." Suffice it to say, I fell immediately and irrevocably in love with the full Irish. I had that same plate of food in the same inn for 3 consecutive days, adoring every bite of it until, on the 4th day, I felt myself sweating pork fat and breathing a little more heavily than usual, at which time I switched to cereal. Much as I love Ireland, if I was going to die a food-related death, I would prefer to do it on my own turf. I've always sought out the full Irish in whatever city I've lived, as a means of comfort and also a way to balance the very important blood sausage content level we've learned to be so important to living a happy life. Fortunately, I found it here in my hometown of New Orleans, at the Irish House on St. Charles Avenue, at the hands of Chef Matt Murphy. I can't say that I have the fortitude to down that magnificent bounty of meat and eggs every day, or even every week, but when I do it with aplomb, and it always makes me think fondly and happily of my time in Ireland, and of that cheery inn owner and his wife, of rolling green hills, of sheep, and the feel of a soft Erin sweater. This St. Patrick's Day, or perhaps the day after, I urge you to avail yourself of a full Irish. I know I will, and probably with a pint of Guinness for good measure, and of course, for strength. I'll wish you cheers as I do so, or as the Irish say, sláinte.
That was food writer and native New Orleanian, Scott Gold.
You don't get more Irish than Dublin-born Chef Matt Murphy, owner of the Irish House on St. Charles Avenue. We spoke with Matt to hear how the Irish celebrate the Feast of St. Patrick's.
I think back home, you've always heard that, you know, St. Patrick saved Ireland. He brought religion to it, stopped worshipping stones and the lunar calendar and all this whatever, you know?
Yes.
So that's what we learned, that St. Patrick, he drove the snakes out of Ireland, which is, you know, the snakes were the devil, right?
Right.
He crushed them and sent them back into the ocean, you know? And as kids, we're sitting in class and we're hearing this and that's it, you know? We're let's celebrate St. Patrick. He saved us all. Everybody has their snakes in their life, whether it's alcohol, the cigarettes, or whatever they're doing, you know? So
he's still busy.
He's busy still.
Any special foods in Ireland that you relate to St. Patrick's Day celebrations?
Not really growing up. I know we would always have an Irish stew. You know, it was still like kind of cold. But we would always have fish on Fridays. You hear corned beef and cabbage here in the US, whereas they call it bacon and cabbage back home, uh-huh. Or a nice roast of a ham. I guess it was more like you have Christmas where you have a big meal, and which was our Christmas is similar to Thanksgiving. But when you get to St. Patrick's Day, it's a little lesser. It's that event in between Christmas and Easter. Mm-hmm. So you would have probably, you know, a meal out, you know.
What are some of the authentic elements of Ireland that you have found lacking in New Orleans and you're maybe trying to make up for at the Irish House?
Well, one of the things in Ireland, I grew up beside Kiltory na hÉireann, which is an Irish society that was all about theatre, music, and a gathering place where a lot of the culture was. In New Orleans, we're so big into culture. And you think if the Irish community that came here has done so much, that was one of the things I thought was lacking. And there was an opportunity there to build something.
So that Irish House, it's a whole cultural center. And
exactly.
I'd like you to tell us, how will you be celebrating St. Patrick's Day this year?
St. Patrick's Day this year will probably be up early in the kitchen, like every holiday occasion. And I'll probably be right in the thick of it, making sure that everybody that's either going to St. Patrick's Cathedral and on their way to the parade and they're stopping off at the Irish House for breakfast gets fed in a timely and fast manner. And then making sure that, you know, like everything, that we have a great celebration and have a blast.
When I was a young man, I carried me pack and I lived the free life of the rover. From the Murray's green basin to the dusty outback, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, me country set sun.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we visit with living legend Terry Fletridge.
I love the music. And I asked the band leader, what music is that? It just carries me away. He said, that's jazz. Oh, okay. And where does it come from? Comes from New Orleans. So I was determined. I wrote in my diary, I am going to New Orleans.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and by Dickie Brennan's Bourbon House. From oysters to redfish, serving fresh Gulf seafood on Bourbon Street, home to the city's largest American whiskey and bourbon collection. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.